I think many of us from time to time have wanted to know what other people are thinking that perhaps that would give us an advantage in a certain situation. But today we're going to talk about something that it's not dissimilar from that. It's learning why people actually do what they do.
Yeah, this is, one of the, biggest questions in psychology, the why of how we behave, what we do, what is it that drives humans to behave the way we do in the world. And of course, looking at answers, depending on who you ask, you get very different approaches to the question, right? This is not a new question, and, we can trace back millennia, but, looking at modern psychology, we look, maybe starting in the almost modern era with thinkers like Freud, who, when looking at behavior would say, well, it's the role of the unconscious, right? That it's, the answer to why lies in the mind, and it lies in a part in the mind we can't even access directly. We can only infer. And while that made for some incredibly interesting writing and some, some wonderfully dense theories, it didn't really generate a technology or procedure we could use in our everyday lives to help us figure out what's going on with behavior and how we can change it. So we've, evolved a bit. And one way we're thinking is to spend a little less time focused on what's in, inside the mind or even in our thoughts and feelings, but instead open up mainly to the environment, what we can observe. That is, can we figure out why someone's doing what they're doing by just looking at what happens before and after their behavior?
Well, I guess that people have theorized about this for long enough now that you have kind of an answer to that, right?
Yeah. And, it's kind of simple. It's the ABCs. What comes before are the antecedents. We're interested in the behavior, and we look what comes after in the consequences. So this is the work pioneered by, the likes of B.F. Skinner and other behavioral psychologists looking at, understanding how the environment can influence behavior. Skinner would say control. He would say everything in the environment, all the behavior can be reduced down to the environment. I think now we use a more gentle term. We would say maybe the environment can influence how we behave. And maybe if we then understand the way the environment's functioning, maybe we could change it in a way and help people behave differently.
So the baseline thinking is take two basically identical people, put them in two completely different environments, and you're going to get two completely different outcomes or patterns of behavior?
Well, sure. And of course, there are biological limits to this, and certainly genetics matter, and thinking, thoughts, and feelings really are behavior, too, that we care about. And so it's not as simple as just we can, take, one of the famous quotes from John Watson is, take a baby and I can turn him into anything, right? A doctor, an engineer, a playwright. And, I think we've sensibly backed away from some of those claims. But, maybe we could put this into practice. So let's say we go into, home and go into the dinner table, families at the dinner table, and we have a child there who, let's say, starts acting up. I don't know what that looks like. Maybe we could say starts cursing at the table. So why would the kid do that?
Well, there's any number of reasons.
Sure. Right. And we could ask directly, but it turns out asking directly often doesn't help. It gets us into the world of the mind. And we'd say, well, he wants to misbehave, or, his brain is wired that way. And then maybe that's true, but it's not necessarily helpful if our goal is to, make dinner a little more pleasant for everyone involved.
But in general, a child's not going to say these words unless he or she's heard them somewhere.
Exactly. So we don't really look to the person to explain it. We look to the environment. So we might figure out what's going on before. So let's say, for example, at the dinner table, there's a conversation going on. The child was trying to participate, but everyone was ignoring the child, right? And we look what happens after. Let's say after cursing, everyone turns to the child and says, oh, you shouldn't do that. That's not appropriate. You should use better words. Let's practice. And they give the child lots of attention. Maybe in that right there, we found out the function. Even if the child can't articulate it, even if we're not looking into the mind, we might think, oh, cursing got attention. It got, he was in a state where the adults weren't paying attention, and all of a sudden he was the center of everything at the table. Kind of cool. But it works different ways, too. Let's say that a different child, same exact curse word, right at the table, says it. And in this time, the consequence is, go to your room right now. And he trudges away to his room, brings his iPad with him, and is on his iPad in his room. Do you have a guess at maybe what that cursing got that kid?
Yeah, probably got them what they wanted.
Yeah, got them escape from kind of a boring conversation. Sometimes our dinner table conversation's not the best, right? That's why you listen to NPR. You get great stories to tell. But sure, in that case, the child, was able to get out of a situation they didn't enjoy. And so this idea of looking to the environment can help us figure out why kids and adults and other, you know, folks in our world are maybe doing the things they do. And I think why that example can be helpful is it's the same exact behavior. So the behavior looks the same, but the function can be different. And if we can understand sort of how behavior functions in the world, whether maybe it gets us attention or gets us something we want or gets us out of something, then we can help think about, well, how could we change the environment to support more appropriate behaviors? So, for example, in the kid who wanted attention at the table, how could we design dinner in a way where the child was able to participate? You know, maybe making sure that, you know, every few minutes you're asking the child a question or engaging them into the conversation so they can be part of, you know, part of those interactions. And for the child who wants to leave, you know, maybe it could be helping them know how much longer is left that they're expected to be there, giving them sort of a sense of 5 more minutes, giving them something to look forward to at the end of the meal, like a dessert. Or it could be even teaching them a more appropriate way to ask for a break, you know, such as, can I be excused or may I be excused? And so if we think about function, it can help us better identify what behaviors we want to see and the function of maybe the behaviors that are giving us some trouble. And what the nice thing here is it gets us away from blaming the person. Notice that the why of those behaviors wasn't in the kid. It wasn't that they were a bad kid. It wasn't that they didn't want to, you know, be, you know, it wasn't that they were flawed in some way. It was that the environment was supporting the behavior we didn't like. And by changing the environment, we can get behaviors that might be better for the child and better for us.
Does that work the other way?
How so?
Can you elicit good behavior by using these same methods?
Oh, absolutely, right? And, you know, think about that. We're designing all the time environments that support the behaviors we want to see. You go to a classroom and you'll see, you know, wonderful teachers are working to create space where students are expressing themselves, where they're working and displaying all the sorts of appropriate behavior we want to see, right? And if you look at good teachers, they're embedding all sorts of opportunities, right? Give you one quick example. We want kids to cooperate, right? And it's nice when cooperation shows up spontaneously in the world, but sometimes teachers can be a little sneaky. What if they design an activity or an environment where cooperation becomes part of that experience? You like cookies?
Yeah.
Well, who doesn't, right? And so what if we have a cookie party in the classroom in preschool? For example, you know, toddlers are not known for their sharing and empathy and pieces like that. It's the era of me, the age of me. But what if everyone gets a, you know, sugar cookie that's blank, and then every kid around the table gets a different ingredient. Some get some sprinkles, some get frosting, some get the, you know, little chocolate chip that you can put on top. And then all of a sudden we're in a situation where, well, cooperation is going to work. If you want sprinkles, you need to ask for them, and you have frosting to share in return. And so there we have adults creating an environment that's encouraging pro-social behavior and actually giving kids a chance to practice skills that are going to be really important in their lives. You know, so sometimes we think about behavior analysis or the idea of changing environments as it's evil, right? That it's fundamentally wrong to manipulate people's behavior. But the way I would look at this is we're doing this all the time anyway, right? We're always creating an environment for someone else to behave, and we're always behaving in an environment. So just thinking about it a little and creating a scientific, you know, technology that can help us design better learning environments is really just harnessing what's already out there and making sure we do so in an ethical way.